In this episode, our guest is Greg Brown, master flight instructor, author, photographer, and columnist for AOPA Flight Training Magazine. We have a great conversation about flying and flight training. In the news, we talk about pilot training at American Airlines, the Boeing 737 MAX first flight, ATC privatization and user fees, and more. All that coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 387 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is Rob Mark. He's a pilot, a flight instructor, an aviation journalist, and publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening, and I hope everybody bears with me. I'm on my mobile device right now, and I'm in the car on the way to the Camp Jetwine Studios, so we'll be back sounding normal here very quickly. Well, normal for me.
Yeah, I was going to say you sound a little funny, Rob, but that's not unusual, so.
I thought you were going to say that.
Yeah, that was too easy, right? That was kind of obvious. Well, so sorry about that. Also co-hosting is Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Max. You've heard of the Do Not Fly list, right?
Yes.
I managed to get myself on a do not rent list.
Did you do?
I actually didn't do anything. Well, I rented a car in Spokane, Washington, and I paid the bill, and I have a receipt showing that I paid the bill, but National Car Rental doesn't think that I paid the bill. So I needed to get a new car, a rental for work, and they've said, nope, we're not going to rent to you. You are on the do not rent list. And we went through this whole thing, and I said, but here's the receipt. I paid. And they're like, yeah, we'll get back to you shortly with an answer. I said, okay, what's your definition of shortly? And they said, oh, within a month or so. My definition of shortly is within 24 hours.
Yeah, or less.
Yeah. Hmm. So
I thought you were going to tell us that you'd done something like, you know, you trashed a rental car like a rock star or something exciting like that. But
no, I paid the bill. Okay. That's what I did.
All right. Very good. Also with us is our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof. David, hi.
Hi, everyone. We had a rough commute home, so I'm frantically getting on the computer and inhaling my dinner at the same time. So I will stop. I will go back on mute to finish my dinner, and we'll be fine later.
Okay. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. The other Max, Mr. Trescott, how are you today?
Hello, Max, fellow co-hosts and listeners around the world. I am doing great. Had a very nice week last week. I had a gentleman finish his IFR check ride successfully, and he's in his 70s, so that's always, you know, good because it can be a little tougher. But the thing I'm looking forward to here is not being in town on Sunday. We've got the Super Bowl coming here to Silicon Valley, and there is a 32 nautical mile TFR, which is going to ground everything from airplanes to half-pound drones for 32 miles around Levi's Stadium from 2 p.m. until midnight, I guess, on Sunday. So, yes, indeed, Super Bowl is a little inconvenient for us local residents.
I guess so. 32 miles.
Long ways, huh? So nothing moves in the inner 10 nautical miles and the outer 10 to 32. You have to be on a flight plan and have a transponder. But, you know, so far, none of my drones can lift the transponder I keep trying to put on it.
Yeah, not yet. Anyway, you got to rewire them, Max. You know.
That's it. Yeah. That's it.
All right. Well, let's introduce our guest this episode. That's Greg Brown. He's a columnist for AOPA. His Flying Carpet column is in its 17th year at AOPA Flight Training Magazine. He also runs a group on Facebook for student pilots called Greg Brown Student Pilot Prep Talk Group. He's been a licensed pilot since 1972 and a CFI since 1979. Greg was the year 2000 National Certified Flight Instructor of the Year. He's the winner of the 1999 NATA Excellence in Pilot Training Award, and he is the first ever Master flight instructor. Greg, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you. And since Robin is in his car, Rob is in his car, and Max Trescott is dealing with a 32-mile TFR, I thought it's worth mentioning that I'm being interviewed at 7,000 feet.
At 7,000 feet?
I am. I'm at 7,000 feet. It's the elevation of Flagstaff, Arizona.
Oh, my
gosh.
But
I wanted you to know that I am at 7,000 feet.
Bada boom.
Yeah. How's the air up there?
It's thin, which accounts for my high voice.
Okay. Greg, you've also written a number of very popular aviation books, including The Savvy Flight Instructor, The Turbine Pilot's Flight Manual, Flying Carpet, The Soul of an Airplane, and You Can Fly. Are you a pilot that likes to write or a writer that likes to fly?
Yeah, what a great question. I would say that when I'm taking my flight review, I tell them I'm a pilot who likes to write, but the reality is I'm probably a writer who likes to fly.
We'll be talking about some of your books, some of your activities, some interesting stories from your years and years of experience. But first, we'll start with the aviation news from the past week. So is everyone ready?
Ready.
Yep.
Ready from the West.
Ready from 7,000.
Our first story or two, let's talk a little bit about American Airlines. We have an item in the Star Telegram. American Airlines launches pilot training and recruiting program at its regional carriers. Well, the new pilot training and recruiting program, it's going to take place at regional subsidiaries. These are wholly owned subsidiaries like Envoy Air, Piedmont Airlines, and PSA Airlines. And they're hoping to bring more pilots into the system and eventually feed mainline operations. So this fits in with some of the other conversations we've had in the last few months, I guess, concerning, well, the pilot shortage, bringing more pilots into the regionals and then seeing them move up into the majors. What do you guys think? Does this sound like this is the right kind of approach? Is American Airlines doing the right thing?
What's different about this one is that they're doing some tuition reimbursement. I think we talked about JetBlue's program probably 2 months ago. This is the first time I've actually heard where airlines are putting up some money, though. $16,000 is going to be a small part of the price of getting to 1,500 hours in an ATP, but I think it's a great start.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's been a long time coming, and I think it's the tip of the iceberg, because we've all known that if they don't have enough bodies, the main line can't get the feed it needs from the regionals. And if they lose that, then they're in big trouble. And it's been coming, and I'm sure it's going to improve from there. So I've also thought, though, that if of course, now, you know, the deal is that you'll have a flow-through, which gives you a priority interview and sometimes a guaranteed interview at the main line. And if you had people at the regional saying, look, my chances of going to American main line are really awesome if I just stay here in this regional airplane for 3, 4, 5 years, you'll get people to come. I don't care about the tuition and the reimbursement, all the rest. They'll come if they think there's a future. And that's what's been missing for a long time. So, but these two things coming together, ooh, I think it's going to be great.
There's been this ongoing argument about whether there's a pilot shortage or not.
Right.
And I think at this point, it's like arguing climate change. Hmm. Most people with any numbers behind them see that we're looking at a gigantic pilot shortage coming. And I'm sure that the many listeners will know, but maybe some won't, that the regionals now, those pilots are getting sucked up into the majors. And so the regionals are offering sign-on bonuses, and a lot of them are covering or helping to finance the new ATP course, which is usually about $20,000 proposition. And I don't know about the rest of you fellas. I just got a solicitation the other day, $5,000 sign-on bonus from Transpac looking for flight instructors.
Yes, so I get I get those mailings periodically as well, not just from Transpac. So, yeah, there's no question. People are really looking for pilots.
And that American Airlines news is a symptom of what's going on industry-wide, which bodes wonderfully for everyone who's starting on any kind of professional pilot career now.
Now, the article mentions that American has created partnerships with over 40 universities and flight schools. So I take that to mean that the actual training is kind of distributed across a number of different organizations, right? Is that the way to interpret that?
I think so. And a friend of mine actually sent me something recently, which was an ad from one of the large flight school here in the U.S. And in the banner, it said airline-sponsored flight training. So I think that was probably direct response to this.
How are they getting around the 1,500-hour rule with this? Because when they go to fly for the regional, don't they still need those 1,500 hours? So what do they do from hour zero until 1,500?
Well, aren't they flying at the regional?
Well, so you don't need the full 1,500 if you have gone to an accredited university. Right. I think it knocks it down to around 1,000 hours if you do that. There's another loophole for folks who have come from the military. I think they can do it with 750 hours. But for folks in some – I'm guessing some of these universities that American has partnered with would qualify for that. But then there is still that problem of how do you get from, say, 250 hours when you've got your commercial instrument and maybe your CFI to even the 1,000 hours. And the answer is the same, I think, as has always been. You find whatever job you can, and you probably don't get paid a lot doing it. But, you do it to get the hours.
Can I pitch in on that? I am thrilled about that in one respect, and that is that historically flight instructors – have been major recruiters of new people brought into aviation, general aviation, pleasure flyers, and professional flyers. So I'm hoping that one positive side effect of this is that while those folks are building their additional flight time, flight experience, they will be out there recruiting more pilots into aviation of all types. So to me, that's a little bit of a silver lining for maybe some folks who are dreading having to build the flight experience.
Let's talk just a little bit about the flight instructors to do all this training. If we're going to have to train this a large number of new pilots, does the problem shift to being a flight instructor shortage?
It's already happening. It's a catastrophe almost already, and it's going to get worse because what's happened is. With the retirements, the majors are hiring out of the regionals are hiring all the flight instructors, and now the demand for flight instructors around the country is already phenomenal. Many good flight schools cannot get enough talent, so it's going to create a lot of opportunities. One thing I've been kind of pushing is that flight schools that are the Part 61, smaller flight schools in particular, should be offering a combined commercial CFI course that targets their local pilots, the folks who, have other jobs maybe, but hang out at the airport and fly all they can and would like to be involved in order to get more locally based pilots or flight instructors who will stay there. But it's going to be a real problem. And I think anyone taking lessons right now has probably seen tremendous turnover in CFIs, and that's only going to get worse.
Hey, Greg, is there a business proposition here for pilots from the majors who are retiring at 65 to go back and be an instructor and help out and contribute to aviation that way?
That's a great idea. I've never heard anyone say it, but absolutely. That's a golden opportunity if they can attract those folks back. I've never seen it verbalized or in print, nor have I thought about it. It's a natural thing, isn't it?
You hear it first at the Airplane Geeks.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if they
wow, I got two great ones in one show. Wow.
They want to do it. That's the issue. I mean, a lot of times when guys hang it up at 60 or 65, they go, I don't even want to fly anymore. I'm okay. I've done enough. And but there are going to be some people, obviously, that just can't get enough of it. And but do we have enough of those enough people?
And they'll also have to have a medical. I mean, their CFIs can do only a few very limited things without having a medical. So that's, for example, teaching student pilots is one of those things. So that's an issue.
Wait a minute. You're supposed to have a medical?
Rob.
But, But, you know, it is worth mentioning that, of course, you only need a third-class medical to instruct. And if this initiative to diminish or remove the third-class medical were to happen, that could open it up tremendously to retired airline pilots and to come back and instruct. I thought that was impossible just a couple months ago, but the fact that the Senate passed that bill about medicals, it suggests to me it is possible there will be third-class medical reform, and that'd be a real good thing for the flight instructing community.
All right. Well, next up, we had a major milestone this past week. Boeing conducted a successful test flight, first flight of the 737 MAX that occurred on January 29th. This was an initial test flight. It was conducted mostly at 15,000 feet. They were speed limited to 250 knots. But it was a little shy of 3 hours. From all reports I've seen, they say it was a success. And this is a great, you know, important milestone for Boeing.
Yeah, there are a few things about this. I absolutely love the new livery of the Boeing test aircraft. I think that's great. One of the things I noticed, it looks like they have the same cowlings as they do on the engine on the 787. Right. So, Max, I was wondering if you could talk about that. And of course, there's the I forget what the name of it is, but the wingtips, they have the ones that go up and down that are really cool.
I think they were calling those the split scimitar winglets.
Yep.
Which has got to be about the coolest winglet name. I mean, that just blows sharklets right out of the water, I think, in terms of being interesting. But yeah, the nacelles have that same kind of trailing edge scalloped look that you see on the 787, which is an effect designed to reduce noise somewhat. What you want to do is you want to mix air with the exhaust in a way that affects the sound signature, and having those scallops is a way to help accomplish that. The 737 MAX, of course, has the new CFMI LEAP 1B engine, which is also available for the Airbus A320 family of aircraft, along with the Pratt geared turbofan. The geared turbofan's not an option on the 737 MAX. CFM International has an exclusive with Boeing on that, so it features higher internal pressures and things like ceramic matrix composite parts to be able to accomplish those higher pressures. There are, I think, a total of four test aircraft, three more to come. Boeing says that they're going to be, you know, running these pretty much flat out 6 days a week through the summer with test flights. You know, hopefully they'll not encounter any big issues that they can't address, because Airbus has got a lead, maybe an 18-month lead on Boeing with the re-engined airplanes.
Yeah, what I find really amazing is they have 3,072 of the 730 MAXs on order. Hmm. So that's an awful lot of aircraft. I still don't know what the world's going to do with them. And the other fun fact is Airbus with the A320neos, they have 4,471 on the books as well.
So, yeah, this is years and years of production.
Yeah, but that's an awful lot of
aircraft. A lot of airplanes. And, you know, anything, as we've said, I mean, anything can happen. The economy could take a dive. There could be other events that affect the demand for this. But, you know, given the sort of the current state of things, the projections are for, you know, great volumes. Now, I think a lot of the orders from airlines for these new generation jets was, you know, motivated by high fuel prices and the desire to fly more efficient jets. I mean, if you're flying something that's 14-15% better fuel burn, that's hugely significant. If the price of jet fuel remains as low as it is, that economic imperative for a new airplane isn't exactly as compelling as it was originally. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, but I don't think oil's going to stay at 30-some dollars a barrel either. So
some people are starting to wonder.
5 years from now, it seems like this will be a good deal to get those planes into their fleet.
Yeah. Oh, I think I figured out how it's going to work. This goes back to a story we reported on a couple of weeks ago. I think the airlines are going to dump all of their current airplanes, buy all the new generation, and the Delta is going to buy all the old stuff at a fraction of the price.
and make a killing in the market with
Exactly. With their $1 million 737s that are 40 years old. Right.
Well, along with their refinery.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Boeing was also in the news recently. They won a contract. This is for the new Air Force One presidential jets. They're going to base the new Air Force One planes on the 747-8. And we see that Boeing was awarded. This is just an initial contract. It's a little over $25 million for some preliminary work. So this process is pretty early on in terms of what's got to happen between now and when we get to some new Air Force One planes. The total value of the two airplanes that they are going to ultimately deliver is believed to be $1.65 billion. So, Air Force One jets cost a lot these days, I guess.
Yeah, and I was saying before about the livery of the 737 MAX. I just wonder if we could update the livery of Air Force One to include something like
Hell no.
But why not? I mean, it is great. It's fantastic looking the way it is, but can it be modernized and updated a little?
No. You don't change perfection.
David likes it the way it is. I don't know how to characterize the difference between what will ultimately be the new Air Force One and your, stock 747-8. There's probably a lot of communications equipment in there. In terms of the aircraft itself, I don't know if there's any modifications to it. David, are you aware of anything of that sort?
Other than air-to-air refueling, electromagnetic pulse repulsion, or EMP hardening. It will require probably an extra deck. It will be completely wired separately for triple redundancy in case there's an attack. Basically, it will look like a 787-8 externally, but internally, it will be a completely different airplane.
Okay, well,
it's the same thing. It's the same thing that was with the 767 tankers. The KC-46 is a completely different airframe as far as wiring and Air Force specs, etc. And the most sensitive airplane in the world to fly happens to be VC-25s, otherwise known as Air Force One. And they are very, very different aircraft from your stock-of-the-mill 747-200. So... And they also have to be around for 50 years. So you can imagine what they're going to do to make them last, since the 747-200s have been around for, were scheduled to be disappear at 30 years. Mm. So
you don't happen to know, David, when these are supposed to enter into service, do you?
I don't think there's a date yet.
Oh, okay.
We're probably two or three presidents down the road before someone's flying on it.
I'm sure there's a joke there, but
Ronald Reagan ordered the set replacement for the 707, the VC-25. Right. It wasn't till George Bush that a president actually got to fly on it. So Reagan ordered it, but never was able to fly on it.
Did they fly Reagan home on it after he was no longer president? I thought that was the first flight was taking him back to California after he left office.
That's a nice touch if it's true, yeah.
Maybe I'm making that up, but I just have a vague recollection.
I think he went home on a 707, but that's okay.
There should be a song about that.
Well, he's got the 707 that he flew on. It's at the Presidential Library. It's VC-2700.
All right, let's talk about our next topic. This is something that's been in the news, is going to continue to be in the news. There's an article in The Hill, private air traffic control plan hits turbulence in Senate. Now, right now, obviously in the United States anyway, the air traffic control system process, what have you, is under the control of the regulatory agency, the FAA. And some in Congress want to put air traffic control under a new non-governmental, non-profit organization. They want to privatize ATC. And they want to fund it with user fees, which has the GA community, for sure, in quite an agitated state. Greg, I assume that this is a topic that you're following fairly closely.
Well, I am. I don't know if I have any more information on it than anybody else does. I think all of us would agree that user fees are scary. I think that, I mean, I'm just talking about personal opinion here. We know there's been a lot of headwinds on it if you read the posts around the internet about it and all that. I personally think if you're going to collect money, the fuel tax is a good way to do it. It's transparent. We already have a bureaucracy to collect it. But, you know, privatization seems to have worked pretty well from a functional standpoint with flight service. So I'm not totally opposed. I'm more worried about, you know, whether they try and implement user fees personally than I am on whether a private organization can do as well as the FAA. I think privatization generally is a good thing. But if they have to fund it through user fees and then we're faced with the sort of system you have elsewhere in the world where you have to pay for a briefing, pay for a landing, pay for every radio communication, and there has to be a bureaucracy to collect it, I'm totally opposed to that. But that's just my opinion. I don't have any deeper knowledge than that.
Yeah, and I think that latter part, I think we would all be opposed to. I think this really comes down to two competing interests. The airlines are desperately looking for ways to come up with a new system so that they can shed some of the costs that they're paying and shift those costs over to GA. Right now, everybody pays a per gallon fuel tax. Obviously, the airlines pay more per gallon to fly a mile than the small airplanes do. And I think they're going to propose what's been proposed in the past, which is that the fees become a per segment fee. So a 747 flying from point to point would pay the same number of dollars to ATC as a 172 flying that same particular route. And I think that that's going to really shift the cost from the airlines to GA. When that happens, GA is going to stop using air traffic control so that they can avoid the fees. That's going to decrease safety. It's going to then spiral the user fees upward. If you've got fewer people paying, they're going to have to raise the fees. And I think that's going to kill GA. We've seen it happen in other countries around the world. I think moving to a system like this really is just a ploy to benefit the airlines, and it's very, very deadly to general aviation. So part of Congress is saying, yes, we should do this. One of the Senate committees has written and said, no, don't do this. So it's going to be quite an arm wrestling match, and I think it all comes to a head at the end of March, which is when the FAA appropriations bill needs to be passed. So we're going to be seeing a lot about this over the next 2 months.
You know, I'd like to add one thing to this. There's always the question about, is it worth joining AOPA? Is it worth joining EAA, the flight instructor organizations, and so on? Do the benefits justify joining? The biggest benefit of joining AOPA and EAA in particular, because they're the biggest, is they're the ones out there fighting for us. They're the ones lobbying in Congress. So one of the most important things any of us can do is to belong to those organizations, even if we don't ever partake of their other benefits, because we are funding the people who are helping to hold this off in Congress. And it's not a small thing. I mean, my dad was a pilot before me, and I remember hearing around the dinner table decades ago about how general aviation was threatened by user fees, privatization, and all kinds of other regulatory issues. And I'm talking about it the 60s. The reason it hasn't happened, those same threats keep occurring over and over again. The reason it hasn't happened is because of the fact that our organizations continue to fight for us. So everyone should join. Pay your $40 and join each of those organizations, and you're helping to hold off those problems.
Yeah, I'll definitely second that. And you know, I'm not a pilot. I'm not an aircraft owner. But I don't know. I think maybe 4 years ago, Bené Wilson explained to me, Greg, just what you explained, and it made sense then. I joined AOPA. I've been a member ever since, and it's, you know, I enjoy the publications. I enjoy the information. So it's, you know, the news and all the, you know, the services that AOPA provides. But to me, the important thing is supporting aviation in that way. And I think that's really important. And it's not that expensive. There's, you know, I think a subscription to Aviation Week costs more than a membership with AOPA for a year.
Oh, by a long shot.
Yeah.
And those are the organizations I think will be making the call probably in the next 6 to 8 weeks to get their members to start writing letters to Congress. And I have no doubt we'll be talking about this. And writing those letters, I think, is going to be every bit as much as important as actually being a member of EAA or AOPA. Yeah, so yeah. I encourage people to sit back, wait for the call. And when we do get it, let's absolutely flood Congress with you know, our feelings about this.
Now, Rob, it sounds like you've returned to the Jetwine Studios.
I have, actually, and, you know, I don't know how far along we are on this topic, but, you know, to second everything that everybody's, or third it, NBAA has a big push as well, the National Business Aviation Association, and with the episode of On the Mark that we're going to play, you'll hear that if you will simply go to nbaa.org/advocacy, you will find this great little database that will tell you exactly how to contact your member of Congress, senator, congressman, senator or representative, either email. And you know what is interesting, too, that they mentioned is that a lot of these folks are on Twitter. And when you send something in an email, it's private. But when you start saying, hey, at our rep, hey, at Jan Schakowsky, what are you doing about this, that, or whatever? All the, you know, 13 or 14,000 people that are on Jetwine Twitter see that. And then when other people retweet it, it goes on and on and on. And that's the kind of thing we need to beat this.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned your On the Mark episode. Rob, should we play that right now?
Well, what the heck? I mean, the intros don't get any better than that. Bada boom.
All right. Here's Rob.
I'm Rob Mark, and this is On the Mark. It's 2016, and the idea of privatizing air traffic control and finding the cash to run the FAA is back in the news. But this time, the plan could affect everyone who flies, whether they're a passenger in a Boeing, in the cabin of a business jet, or flying their own Cessna 172. And this plan's also going to be watched very closely by members of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. Now, here's the story everybody needs to hear. Each of the previous attempts to pull air traffic control out of the bureaucracy was carefully crafted, not by all users, but only by the airline industry, under the guise of better efficiencies at lower costs. But for the airlines, privatizing ATC is really just about money and control. If they can dominate a privatized ATC's board of directors and fund it with user fees based on weight and distance traveled, they're pretty much going to control air transportation in America. And they'd like to do it with zero congressional oversight. And who has more experience with user fees than the airlines? They're raking in billions in record profits on the backs of their customers right now. The rush to act? That's because the current FAA reauthorization expires just weeks from now, on March 31st, 2016. The airline industry's trade group, Airlines for America, or A4A, is already crafting their own vision of the nation's air transportation system. And they're working alongside the powerful chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, Pennsylvania's Bill Schuster. But airline passengers, business, and general aviation, we weren't even invited to the negotiation table. We've all been told to just be patient and comment when the legislation appears, that Congress will take care of us. But with that reauthorization's expiration date fast approaching, the pressure to leave any legislation intact when it does appear is going to be enormous. Now, remember back when the healthcare reform legislation first debuted a few years ago? Almost no one in Congress knew what was in that bill either before they voted on it, except, of course, for the private companies that had helped craft the deal. Remember those promises? Trust Congress. It'll all work out fine. Uh-huh. But something's different with the A4A's plan to user finance a private ATC system this time, though. Not all of the airlines support it. Delta Airlines was so unsure of where this spin-off and the control legislation was headed that they eventually withdrew from their own trade association rather than be dragged down this road. Now, Delta's emerged as one of America's really great airlines, and their CEO, Richard Anderson, is a pretty smart guy. So if Delta's saying, hold your horses, why shouldn't everyone else? Even UPS and FedEx, the A4A's primary cargo carriers, don't seem convinced of this plan either. Like the healthcare debate, the big question is, who pays if the A4A's plans don't work out? That's right. Airline passengers, first through more ticket fees, the same ones that sent airline profits soaring. The rest of us, of course, will be tapped to make up the difference. So if you enjoy any of the benefits of air transportation today, please don't be a spectator on this one. Congress doesn't listen to lobbyists the way they do when constituents call. Grab your smartphone and visit nbaa.org/advocacy. Tell Congress to take a breath and really read the FAA legislation this time before they mess up the safest and best air traffic control system in the world. For On the Mark, I'm Rob Mark. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.
All right, well said, Rob.
Well, and Max, I have to thank you for your technical expertise there, because the really sharp-eared listeners may have heard me say thanks for watching at the end. And that was actually an audio strip from a video version of that editorial that was co-produced with the folks at aviationpros.com. So, Max, I have no idea how you did that, but thank you. And again, it's easy, guys. Doesn't cost a dime. nbaa.org/advocacy. Put in your zip code. It'll show you how to get to the folks and tell them you're mad as hell and you're not going to take it anymore.
All right, again, we're speaking with our guest, Greg Brown. Greg, again, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you.
Now, you've been flying for a long time, I think, and you got into flying at what age did you start?
I was a college student. I started at, I got my license at 19, so I guess I started at 18.
Were you one of those kids that, you know, looked through the airport fence and said, I got to do that? What was the sort of the impetus for you?
Actually, I was pretty fortunate. My dad, whose name was Harold Brown, he was a doctor, and he took flying lessons starting in 1949 and actually had owned airplanes the whole time I was growing up. He had several before I was born, and there's a story in our family about one of us as young children asking at the table at dinner one night, Dad, are there some families that don't have airplanes? So we grew up with it. We took all our family vacations in it. And my dad was quite an adventurous flyer. One particular trip of note that he did in 1962 when I was a little kid, he had a Cessna 310C. They took out the back seat, put in a 140-gallon fuel tank, and he and his buddy, Eddie Hayes, flew that airplane to Europe. Now, what was different than the typical light plane to Europe trip is that they flew from Gander to the Azores, Gander, Newfoundland to the Azores, nonstop, over 10 hours over water. And in those days, that was quite an accomplishment. Then they went on to Europe, flew around, and on the way back, they were between Lisbon, Portugal, and the Azores halfway, and they got engine roughness. And the story goes they had he and Eddie Hayes had quite a discussion about which engine it was, because they were scared to death to shut the wrong engine off, but they didn't know if they would have fire or what was going to happen. So they finally determined it was the left engine and shut it down, and it was a good call, and they had to radio their position via a nearby airliner to the Azores to let them know that they'd lost the engine and were running late. And it was kind of a neat story. They got to the Azores. The airline crew was going there, met them there, and took them out to dinner. It turned out one cylinder had cracked all the way around within a quarter of an inch of blowing off.
Wow.
And that cylinder was replaced, and I have the cylinder today. He made a lamp out of it when he returned. But he was a former president of the Flying Physician. So we grew up with it, and I was a real lucky guy. We all know how hard it is to pay for flying. And my dad, when all of us were in high school, said, hey, if any of the four of you want to take flying lessons, I'll pay for your private. Anything more, you got to pay for. And my brother Alan and I both took him up on it. So I learned in the UW Flying Club in Madison, Wisconsin.
Did those early experiences affect you as a flight instructor? Did they have some influences on your approach to flight instruction or how you thought of it?
It did. I think it may have had a bigger effect on how I viewed flying, because we traveled all over in it. I saw the airplane as transportation to go exciting places from the day I learned to fly. In fact, a couple years after I learned, I was at University of Illinois at that point. We rented the Flying Illini 172, my roommate and the guy across the hall and I, and we flew down to West Palm Beach and met one of their buddies there, and we flew to the Bahamas. Well, as a college student, you know, in today's world in general, we don't see as many people making these long trips in airplanes. And I think that my view of it and seeing it as great adventure to fly all over the place, and it had a huge impact. Now, that obviously shaped my instructing, because like all of us here, I love to fly. And I think that one of the prime missions of a flight instructor, in addition to the obvious part of teaching the knowledge that has to be taught and the skills, is to impart the enthusiasm that helps sustain each individual pilot's flying and also helps us attract new blood into it. So that, I guess I've made a long answer out of a short question there. I think the enthusiasm for piloting that goes way beyond just mastering the techniques to the point of adventure and travel, that's probably the single biggest impact on my flight instructing from what I grew up with.
Now, Max Trescott, you were the National CFI of the Year, what, in 2008, was it?
That's true. And I was kind of funny, because when I was named 2008 CFI, one of the people I called up was Greg to say, hey, Greg, what can you tell me about this? What kinds of things do you think I should be doing this year now that I've received this? And it's kind of a fun little club, actually. When we run into each other, those of us who've had that award, if I see Doug Stewart, I'll call him 04, and if I see Rich Stoll, I'll call him 06, and Greg calls me 08. But when I see Greg coming,
And Max calls me a big zero.
No, I call him when I see Greg coming. I go, uh
oh. Okay, for being the year 2000.
The year 2000. Yeah. Big
exactly.
Zero.
Yeah. Exactly. No,
Max, do you remember what I told you?
I do, actually. Do you remember?
I do. And I think it's worth mentioning, because I think it impacts all of us. Well, Max was asking, what was worth doing there. And my observation was that when you get any kind of an honor like that, be it CFI of the Year or be it nationally or locally or in your state or whatever, it kind of gives you the bully pulpit. So it's an opportunity to get some attention and express issues you're concerned about and interested in and want to endorse to the aviation population at large. So I would encourage anyone who any type of award that gives you recognition in the community, take advantage of it. Pick a pet cause within general aviation or aviation as a whole and spread the word on it, because for a short moment there, you got your 15 minutes of fame, as Andy Warhol would say. Take advantage of it, and get your word, your mission out there. Hmm.
Yeah, what I did differently after talking with you was every time I gave a presentation, I made sure that I asked if there were CFIs in the audience. I had them stand up. I had people applaud them, give them recognition, and then encourage others in the audience who had any inkling that they might be looking to give back a little to aviation to consider becoming a flight instructor. So that kind of changed my modus operandi a little bit. So thanks for the suggestion.
Well, it's very cool how you implemented it. First, I've heard of that, and, of course, I wholeheartedly believe in what you're doing there.
Greg, any advice for people who are looking for flight instruction when it comes to selecting a good flight instructor?
Oh, that's a tough one. First of all, it's a professional service, but it's personally delivered. So it's in a category, in my mind, with accountants, with attorneys, with doctors, in that these people vary tremendously in quality. And you should seek references. If you're thinking about taking flying lessons, don't just settle for the first person you meet. Ask around. What's a good flight school? If you can, meet some pilots or know some pilots at various airports. Who's a good instructor? So that you got a reference for someone good. And then the second thing I like to recommend to people who are considering learning to fly and shopping for an instructor is to interview them. And the one of the things I like to see them do is to prepare maybe three questions that they're going to ask each of these CFIs. One of them is, please explain to me the process by which I will earn my certificate. Another one is, please explain to me something that requires a little technical knowledge, like, I hear all about these stalls. What are they? Can you explain to me what stalls are? And the third one is to ask them if it's possible to set a timeline for completing the training. So each of those serve a purpose. One thing you're finding out throughout is their communication skills, right? Mm-hmm. The second thing is when they're explaining the technical item, you're learning about their ability not only to communicate well, but to explain something that you don't understand in a manner that you can understand. So you're testing them there. And the final thing is you want a goal-oriented instructor whose objective it is to finish you, not to just start and kind of go with the flow. So I find that the discussion about, I'd like to take my family on vacation in June. Could I actually finish my license then? How would we do it? Or, having some kind of a discussion about an ending to this process. So those are the bits of advice I always give to people. One, ask around and get references, and two, interview them with a few key questions.
So it's more than just the lowest price is what you're saying.
But it's interesting you should mention price. Can we talk about that for a little bit?
Yes, of course.
Let's do it.
So we all know flying is expensive. We also, I think, all know that the research indicates that it's not the biggest reason that people quit, the cost. However, there's a marketing aspect of this that I think needs to be revisited after all these years. We're all accustomed to the normal approach of you're going to rent an airplane hourly rate and you're going to rent an instructor hourly rate and you're going to add up all those numbers and you're going to get some kind of total. And there are reasons for that. It's hard to predict how much is going to cost, how one student versus another, weather issues, airplane issues. However, I think it's time that we start marketing flight training in terms of a total price, not in terms of hourly. Now, it may still be billed hourly, but think about this. I mean, when you start talking $10,000, $12,000, that's a lot of money, right?
Sure.
So no wonder people hesitate. But what does a used car cost?
Yeah.
$10,000, $12,000. And what does a new Harley cost?
About the same.
16?
Yeah. Yes.
What does a new speedboat cost? So I was thinking about this the other day. You take a look in our local neighborhood here, and there's a used four-wheel ATV for sale for $12,000. That's better than becoming a pilot that you can flying your airplane around the rest of your life.
Good point.
And so I think that we need to kind of rethink about this. So you can earn your private for for half the cost of a new car, you can earn your private for half the, and a cheap new car at that, right? For half the cost of a kitchen remodel. Are you interested in a luxury cruise with your wife? You can become a pilot and enjoy this the rest of your life for the cost of a luxury cruise. So I think we need to get people thinking more that way. And one of the reasons is because I think it helps them understand that it actually is a good value, even though it's expensive.
And you know, Greg, if I can just chime in, I think you said please. Something that's really important, which is if someone learns to fly, I mean, I learned to fly when I was pretty young at 18, but if you did it at 25, if you did it at 30, 35, I mean, you could have a whole lot of time to fly yep. in your lifetime. And since everybody loves to do the math, amortize that over the cost of learning to fly.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. The other thing is when you start talking about a $10,000 or $12,000 investment right up front, if any one of us decides we're going to remodel our kitchen or we're going to buy a motorcycle or whatever, there's a little planning involved, right? It's not like golf lessons or tennis lessons where you're just going to go out there and I'll pay, you know, $80 or $200 or whatever the, you know, it's not that kind of decision. You decide, hey, we're going to remodel our kitchen, or I'm going to buy a motorcycle. I'm going to start saving my money. I might borrow a little bit here. And you come up with a plan. And I think that when you offer flight training in that context, you get people thinking more about planning for a total package. Now, here's another aspect of it. Back to the hourly pricing, the cheaper outfit versus the more expensive outfit. Well, we all know that the cheap outfit isn't always cheaper than the expensive outfit, is it? I mean, a great example is an auto mechanic, right? We've all had our car fixed. You might find a cheap guy who takes 15 hours to figure out what's wrong, and you might find the expensive guy who figures it out in an hour because she's a better diagnostician. So when you start looking at total costs, it's easier to incorporate the fact that you have a more efficient program than the cheaper hourly rate place across the field.
Yeah, you do get what you pay for. I saw a great local example of that. A gentleman was looking to learn to fly in a Cirrus that he had bought. So he had the airplane. He wasn't a pilot. He shopped around because that's always been his nature to get the best price. He found a young fellow who had almost no time in the Cirrus who was willing to give him an amazingly great rate to teach him to fly in it. This guy had over 30 hours when he came to him, and the guy had still not let him, you know, even come close to landing the airplane.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it's no surprise, right? The good deal CFI was happy to sit there and kind of learn how to fly the plane himself, but was scared to death to let the client get it close to the ground. So we immediately had this guy start to do landings, and he switched to me rapidly. So another question I think I would ask folks is, how much time do they have on a particular type of aircraft that you're thinking of flying in? And do they specialize in it, or do they try and do all things for all people? Are they a jack of all trades? And the jack of all trades usually take longer on, on some things.
Well put. Couldn't agree more.
No, I thought it was really interesting. A few shows ago when we had Don Sebastian on, he talked about buying a used 152 with a bunch of, or possibly with some other friends, and sharing the cost of the aircraft. And then after you finish your training, then sell the aircraft. And really, you've flown for free because you've owned the aircraft during that time. And I thought that was a really interesting, novel way of looking at this and really helping to reduce the cost there.
Well, I wrote a column called Affordable Adventure. If anyone wants to read it, you can find it on it was in Flight Training, or you can find it on my website, gregbrownflyingcarpet.com. Just search for Affordable Adventure. But it's about a neat guy named Matt Peacock, who lives up in upstate New York. He's a nurse, and he was driving 4 hours each way, I believe, to do weekend, cover weekends somewhere far away, and started taking flying lessons. And he thought, boy, well, maybe I should buy my own plane and, apply some of the cost of lessons toward having a plane of my own. And he bought a 150 for, I think, $23,000, which was actually, as I remember, IFR equipped. It was a very nice 150. And you start detailing the costs on all this. It's a very affordable vehicle to own and fly. And, of course, you're making some compromises there. I think one of the challenges we all face in aircraft ownership is what's your dream airplane? Everybody would like to have a new Bonanza or a Cirrus or maybe even a jet. But just like everybody in the world can't own a new BMW M series, not everyone in the world can afford to own those more extreme aircraft. And I think if you look in the terms of what you can afford, a surprising number of people taking lessons can go buy an airplane they can learn. And I like to say it's better to fly a 150 than to sit around at home reading about jets.
Greg, tell us a little bit about some of your books. Maybe start with the Savvy Flight Instructor. What's the message in that book?
That book is a business book and an effective it's how to succeed as a flight instructor, but it's not about how to make better landings or do steep turns. You know, someone goes and takes their CFI training, which is rigorous, and they get all the way through that. They can write lesson plans. They can explain lazy eights. Right? They know how to do mysterious logbook endorsements, like something Merlin might do. But where are the flight students going to come from? How are they going to keep them flying? How are they going to prepare them to pass the test? How are they going to handle cases where there's a motivational problem or a personality problem? So the Savvy Flight Instructor is all about the practical aspects of succeeding in flight training, and that includes making money at it, pricing your services, for example. And that book came out in 97, and then some of you may know that the new one just came out last week, the second edition. A lot about marketing in there. We've got a lot of new material about, for example, didn't exist in 97, social networking, how you can use that to keep your flight students motivated and encourage their friends to take lessons and so on. It's sort of a business and motivation handbook, how to succeed as a flight instructor.
And can I say that it was one of the first books I bought when I became a flight instructor back, 2001. So, yeah, I found it very helpful.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think something else that's really needs to be said with being a flight instructor is that we've all met flight instructors that were astounding, that we really learned a lot from, but we've also met some that didn't do such a great job. And because they're looking at their real job aspiration, which is flying for the airlines or flying a Falcon or what have you. And it's really important that a flight instructor understand that this is the industry's little piece of the pie. This is where everybody starts. And you, I guess in a way, maybe it's like being a parent.
Yes.
Give somebody the wrong answers, two or three of the wrong answers, and you can screw them up for the rest of their life. You just have to ask my daughter. She'll tell you that. And you can turn somebody off and they'll never come back to flying. And it's because of your attitude as an instructor. So if you're going to do the job, if you're going to take the time to go through all the training to become a CFI, for goodness sake, do a good job of it while you're there and don't make it so hard on everybody that comes after you.
And, conversely, to build on what you've just said, the joy of delivering someone's dream to them, of putting an airplane key in their pocket, right? There's nothing that beats it. And every one of us has a CFI who appears in our head periodically when to say, should you fly into that weather, right? Is this a good day to take off? Hey, each of you guys, who soloed you?
Yeah, and I think the legacy we leave with each of those students is probably they actually hear our voice. My students hear Max's voice telling them, stay out of that cloud, or, little high and little, fast, better go around and things like that, which is
Max, who soloed you?
Oh, me? It was the Pennsylvania Flight Instructor of the Year, Dick Johnston.
Rob?
It's a fellow that probably is long since gone to heaven, at least I hope, because he was a dope as a flight instructor. And so maybe I'll just keep his name. Should I mention his name?
Well, if you don't want to. As long as you remember it.
Oh, I remember it.
How about the other Max? Who was you? Yeah. Who soloed you?
No, I'm not a pilot myself.
Oh, I shouldn't have brought that up. Should
That's okay.
Now we've been
David.
Trying.
Are you a pilot?
He doesn't seem to get it. He just doesn't seem to want to. He gets $57,000 a month in retirement money, and he still thinks he's broke.
I gotcha.
Rob, how did you know that?
Mine was Bob Vedder, and I don't know whatever happened to him, except what has always troubled me is trying to look him up a few years later, I heard that he had left to join the seminary, and I always wondered if flying with me had anything to do with it. But my point is that in terms of people considering becoming an instructor, when you think about the thousands of people's lives you affect down the line, when you teach someone to fly and you all the people they inspire, all their passengers over a lifetime, some of them are going to become airline pilots. One of my former students who I gave private training to in airplanes and gliders, Ellen Dean, ended up on the championship world aerobatic team a number of years ago. And it's just an unbelievable kick. So if you can be good at it, it is a really wonderful, rewarding thing that you just, you know, I can't say enough about how much fun it is. I'll bet, Max, I'll bet you'll agree with me on that.
You know, I think we should mention the converse as well. I think for folks that want to get their, you know, 1,500 hours for the airlines and they're just not, they really don't warm up to the idea of teaching, don't do it. You know, go get the hours somewhere else. Because there are lots of other ways. You can fly cargo, you can fly traffic watch, you know, you get the hours just as fast. If you know, if you're really not kind of into the idea of helping other people achieve their goals, you know, go work directly on your goal, and there are lots of other ways to do it.
Well put.
Well, but you know, I think that there are interesting aspects. I mean, I know when I got my, let's see, what year did you get your CFI, Greg?
79.
I think I got mine at 75. But so, you know, it's funny because when I started teaching, I was so brand new. And of course, all you know is that you know a little more than the actually, you know a lot more than a student pilot.
But you don't necessarily know that.
No. That's actually what I was going to say. And you're just kind of doing what the CFI school taught you to do. And you're going, yeah, okay, I do this, I do that. And then, and I was. I don't know where this came from with a student that I got a private and an instrument from, and then he went out and bought a Blanka Viking, which for those of you that may not have known that airplane, it was about the size and capability of a Beach Bonanza. And it was a nice airplane. They stopped building them long ago. But and this fellow took the airplane on a cross country down to Florida. He took it out to the Bahamas, and you know, he listened to all my stuff about, you know, make sure you've got a raft and don't put the raft in the baggage compartment, because if you need it, it's not going to do you any good. And but if it ever happened, I said, remember, if you ever had to go down in the water, the last thing you want to do is you know, keep the gear up and make sure you pop the door, because if the airplane ever hits the water, it could deform the airframe and the door might not open. He went, okay, yeah. And you know, you say things like that, and people say, where did you – I don't know. Some other guy told me that. Didn't this guy put the Viking in the water down in the Bahamas? Airplane sank. He and the passenger he had with him, a young lady, were on a raft for 2 days before the U.S. Coast Guard found them. And when he came back to Chicago, they had a big – to do, because his mom and dad and he were all in the media business. And he came up to me at the airport and he hugged me. He said, thank you for telling me to open that door just before we hit the water. And
that's awesome.
Whoa.
That's great.
And that's when it really hit me. And I went, oh my God, I saved these two people. And all I was doing was kind of what and that's when I started to realize that, you know, we really have an incredible responsibility at our fingertips, I think, and we really have to make sure that we – of course, that's the only incredible thing that's ever happened the rest of my flying career, but at least that was a good start.
Oh, and I had one of those. I had a lady come up to me a couple years ago who said, you saved my life, and I was like, whoa, really? I mean, that's pretty incredible. She was flying charter late at night, and I had told her, make sure if you know, if it's dark and you're not aware where the mountains are, that you're always above 4,500 feet in the San Francisco Bay Area. And this is 1:30 in the morning. She punches the captain on their King Air you know, flight and said, hey, call ATC now. He was like, what? She says, call them right now. And they did, and the guy said, immediately, climb immediately. And you know, they were in danger. So yeah, we do have an effect on people's lives.
Greg, I wanted to ask you about the student pilot pep talk group on Facebook. You know, I just pulled it up, and I'm looking at these faces here, and it's filled with people. I mean, here's Jason Miller, Trevor Smith, B'nai Wilson, Rod Rakic. There's Max Trescott. Let's see. Bill Roetz there, David Allen, Carlene Pettit, Tom Haines. I mean, these are all Jeff Ward. I mean, these are all people. Scott Spangler's there too. These are all people that, you know, that we know, that I know. What goes on over at this Facebook group?
Well, first of all, I want to encourage anyone to join who is interested in looking for support or to help others. Here's the genesis of it. And I have to tell you, I never would have predicted this. If you said, Greg, what is your single proudest accomplishment as a flight instructor in terms of helping get and keep people flying? It's probably that group. It's probably more than CFI of the Year or my books or magazine articles or anything else. And I'll tell you why. First of all of us have encountered this, right? You meet somebody who's taking lessons and they're just at the point where they're getting discouraged, they're having trouble with steep turns or having trouble with landings. And you bump into them at the airport and then somebody says, Max, I'm thinking I'm going to quit. You know, I've just, the last five lessons, I've been stuck in the pattern. It's been really tough. I can't get my landings down. And when you're listening to this, you're thinking, well, this is true of everyone since the Wright brothers has had this problem. But they are thinking, I'm not cut out to do this. And one example of this type of thing, a buddy of mine here in town, Mark Harris, who I first met, the guy was, he played basketball. He's a terrific athlete. So he says, I'm a great athlete and I can't get these landings down. What's wrong with me? Well, any one of us in this group and the largest number of our listeners, given 10 minutes with that person, we can, you know, make them feel better, soothe their ruffled feathers, and convince them that this happens to everybody and it's just a learning plateau and they will continue. Would you agree? And that's a pep talk. If you're learning to fly in a place where you don't have any interaction with other people, like a remote area with very few students, a busy city place where there's no time to talk to anyone else, those pep talks aren't available. And if your CFI doesn't give you the pep talk, or sometimes people don't believe the CFI, if there's not another party at the flight school giving the pep talks, then we lose people that we could keep flying in 10 minutes. So I've been on a mission on this for quite a long time. Facebook provides the perfect platform for that. Student pilots join this group, and they're scared to death of tomorrow's stage check. And there's a dozen people who have all been through it last week who are telling them, don't worry, you'll do fine. And they're giving them a little pep talk. And they help them over the rough spots, give them tips. People have questions about, you know, how do I use flight following and such happened, what should I do? So what's happened in this group, we got about 1,300 members, a lot of flight students, but also it's been going in several years now. We have a lot of people who graduated onto their private who've stayed in to counsel those behind them, and they're working on, now they need help on instrument, and some of them have become flight instructors. And then we've got this marvelous group of people like the ones you named who pitch in and give the pep talks and share the expertise. And it is the most incredible thing. And we made the group private because somebody in the group, in fact, I know who it was, his name was Neil Braden, he pointed out that if you are having, let's say you got scared last lesson by something that happened, you don't want to post it in a public Facebook group because then it appears on your own page. And then your friends might see that you got scared and your family might, and that's bad, right? Or there might be an FAA, you know, a regulatory implication to what they did. So we made it private, and it gives everyone the opportunity to share things that happened to them. I'm astonished at how many people, now that GoPro cameras are in at such a level, share videos of the most god-awful landings. And so listen, hey, everybody, what can I do to fix this?
It's a safe space.
It's a safe space. There's a sympathetic bunch, and we don't tolerate any negativism in there. I just remove them from the group. Anybody who's negative, the whole idea is encouragement. And we also try really hard to keep it focused on flight training issues.
Well, Greg, do you have to be a student pilot in order to join, or what if you're a wannabe?
We've got some wannabes in there. They are most welcome. And also, we really value folks like yourselves who, you know, there's no obligation. You don't have to be there every day answering every question. But I think we all find that topics come up that we've got a good answer to, and we share them. One guy who's been a terrific resource is Bruce Williams, if you know him, written several books, and he's an expert on integrating flight simulator into training. We got a bunch of really terrific contributors. The one thing I'll say, like everything in Facebook, I run into problems with scammers and spammers and fake people and those who aren't really seriously interested. If you're an aspiring pilot, or if you're a pilot who doesn't have any information about your flying on your page, then go ahead and message me through that site and tell me how you're involved with flying. Because the one challenge I've had is in trying to keep the group appropriate. Sometimes there are people who are learning to fly or wanting to learn, and you can't tell by looking that they have any connection to it. So drop me a text if you're in that situation.
So then that thing I mentioned before we started the show about people giving me their credit cards and I'll help them make all this happen, that probably wouldn't be a good idea then, would it? Okay, Rob, I'm just kidding.
Rob, we're going to send you back to Nigeria. So.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, there's a prince we want you to meet.
You know what's really funny, though? You know, we all see those crazy things. I have answered maybe half a dozen of them in the last year just to say, yeah, wow, you're the person I've been looking for. I'd love to help you get this $27 million in whatever. And, of course, they never answer you because send it to 183 other million people.
They got bigger fish to fry.
Yeah, that's true. But student pilots, man, we got to keep them going.
Well, Greg, I have to tell you, I'm having a lot of fun with this conversation, and we're just scratching the surface. We do need to press on soon with the rest of the show. So I just want to give you an opportunity. If you've got a story or some point that you'd like to make to our audience, we'll kind of give you the stage and take it away.
Well, you know, I had planned to tell a little story about where flying carpet came from.
Yes.
But I think since I've got my one topic here, I'm actually thinking about doing something else.
Okay.
And that something else is, you know, we're all concerned about continuing to grow the pilot population.
Yes.
And there are some things all of us can do to make that happen. And I would like to refer, I've got a buddy named Jim Pittman. He actually is a former Arizona CFI of the Year, and he was a Western Regional Manager for Cessna Pilot Centers for quite a while, and he's a really neat guy. We got to talking one time about why people don't seem to want to learn to fly today, and he made the observation that these days most people's exposure to flying is from an airline seat. And that, of course, it's an awful experience. Most of the airline experience is awful. And then they're sitting there looking out their little bitty window in the back. And to quote Jim, if this is what flying's about, I'm not interested. And he went on to point out the fact that if you put someone, bring them into your airplane or an airplane and take them flying, and you give them the controls, a huge percentage of the population is instantly hooked. And so I would just like to remind everyone of the importance. Sure, it's fun to fly with your pilot friends and all that, and we should all do that. There's a lot of benefits to it. But if you have a buddy or a friend, when I say buddy, of course, I mean male or female, or even transgender, anybody you know who expresses an interest or might be interested, by all means, take advantage. Take those people up. Take young people up who are excited and want to go flying, and don't just take them for a ride. You know, obviously, pick a good day, make sure it's smooth and all that, but give them a chance in the right seat. You know, if you're a private pilot, you need to be a little cautious. Just be sure, you know, you're up at a safe altitude and you're watching what's going on around. Give them the controls. Let them fly the plane. Take a picture of them flying the plane or a video and post it on their Facebook page. Let them get the glory that, you know, Don Smith flew an airplane yesterday. And if all of us do that, we will have an impact on improving the number of folks learning to fly.
Yeah, it's such a simple thing in many ways that can have such a huge impact. I think you're right, Greg.
It's power that all of us have to help grow passion for our activity get more people involved, and that's how we lower costs. That's how we keep the government from implementing bad things that we don't like user fees. We got to get more people in. And it's as simple as getting as many people as humanly possible behind the controls.
All right.
It's an awesome point, Greg. I think for folks that are on the outside looking in, aviation kind of looks like a club or a closed community that they don't know how to become a part of. So a lot of times I've heard that people, you know, tried flying simply because somebody asked them. Somebody said, hey, come flying with me. So I think you raise a really excellent point. We got to just keep, you know, asking people to come along and fly with us. So there's no point in – in fact, I've found it's always more fun to fly with somebody anyway. You know, flying by yourself, it's not nearly as much fun as flying with somebody else.
Is there anything more fun than turning someone new onto it? I mean, one thing that's always blown my mind is, you know, all of us, we've been pilots for a while, most of us here, and I can take somebody up for 30 minutes or a 45-minute flight, and I may forget it tomorrow, but they will remember that for the rest of their lives. So the impact is phenomenal when you take someone flying and let them handle the controls, and they're going to tell all their friends, they'll always remember it. And even if they don't choose to learn themselves, others are going to ask about, well, was it hard? Could I do it? It's that simple.
And if anyone's in Southern California that wants to take me flying, send an email to brian@airplanegeeks.com, and
Brian's
I will
ready
be there
to go.
And go flying with
all
you.
Right. Greg, tell us once more where we can find your website.
Okay, well, my personal website is gregbrownflyingcarpet.com. And the on Facebook, you can find my page there at facebook.com/gregbrownflyingcarpet, trying to differentiate myself from all the other Greg Browns out there. And then the Facebook group we discussed is Greg Brown's Student Pilot Pep Talk Group. And I found if you search under even Pep Talk or Student Pilot Pep Talk, you can find it. You can forget my name without any difficulty, and you'll still find it.
And, of course, we'll put all those links in the show notes, as well as the books that you've written. What's the easiest way to find those? Is it on Amazon?
All my books are available. ASA is the publisher of all of them. There's actually one I forgot to write on there, if you can believe it, called Job Hunting for Pilots. I think I forgot to list there if you want to add it. You can go to my website, gregbrownflyingcarpet.com. You can go to ASA because all the books are available under my name there. Amazon carries them all. Most of the big, you know, Sporty's, Pilot Mall, you know, the good pilot shops, they carry them. So they're readily available. They can even be ordered through a bookstore. And they're all available. Well, most of them are available as ebooks of various varieties. And one thing I'll mention while we're talking about this, the new edition of Savvy Flight Instructor that just came out, it's the second edition, that is not quite available everywhere yet just because it's brand new. So that one, you know, you might search for. Certainly ASA has it. You can get it as an iBook, I know. But I believe, for example, Amazon does not yet show the Savvy Flight Instructor second edition. But all the rest of them are available. I've got a Flying Carpet book, which is related to my column that many of you read in Flight Training Magazine, and I'm real proud of that. And that's a great one for if you want to share with your family members what flying's about. Flying Carpet's fun for pilots, but it's written to be accessible to your friends and family too.
All right. Greg, I get the sense that you're not even close to slowing down in life yet.
Well, I feel mighty lucky. I mean, the opportunity to spend a large portion of my life involved in a field I'm passionate for. We all love flying. And I think, wouldn't you guys agree, the aviation community of pilots is such a warm, interesting, diverse bunch.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And normally they are a pretty nice bunch of people. There's always those weird ones out there. But actually, if you go up to a pilot at the airline and you're in the terminal somewhere, just walk up to them like you know what you're doing and say, so what airplane are you on? And they immediately know that you got it.
Yep.
Because they'll start blabbing about how cool flying is.
Yeah.
We're so lucky. I think one of the coolest things about it is, obviously we all have a high respect for airline pilots and their amazing accomplishments, but one thing that always blows my mind is that if I fly a couple hundred miles in the 182 and land and a non-pilot picks me up at the airport, they're far more impressed than they are with an airline pilot. Of course, it's misplaced, But the fact is that those of us who fly around in light airplanes, we're doing something a lot of other people just, it blows their mind that we can
do. That is absolutely true. And we do not want to lose sight of that, because everybody that flies the big ones or the middle-sized ones started with the little ones.
Yep.
But I got to say, for folks that are interested in the airlines, before you go for that first interview, you got to get Greg's The Turbine Pilot's Flight Manual. I bought that before I did my first training at Flight Safety, which was for the Cessna Caravan, which is a turbine. And boy, did that help. It's really, really, if you've been flying pistons, it's a little hard to figure out all the systems in turbine aircraft. And so I love that book.
Hey, a quick word about that if you're interested. The reason that book exists, Max, is because I had been flying piston planes for years, and when I was in my late 30s or so, the airline picture opened up. So I went to the library and to the bookstore to try and buy a book like that to learn about jets. No such book. So that's the reason it exists, and it is modeled after David McCauley's book for children, How Things Work. Huh. Have any of you ever seen that before?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
How toilets work and how – so. I'm proud of the fact, even though I took some flack initially from some university types, there are no formulas in that book. That book is all schematic. It explains in principle how everything works, so that it's not specific to any airplane. But you can walk the walk and talk the talk after you read that book. And that helps you at your interview. It helps you during training. You know what bleeds are. You know what leading edge flaps are. You know, the things you need to know are there. So I think it's something that if you're at all interested in, you know, what's happening to that wing out there when the airliner comes in to land and you're flying a 150, you probably would still enjoy it because it explains all the different equipment found in turbine airplanes.
All right. Very good. Again, Greg Brown, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, folks. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, by the way, Greg, if you're still at 7,000 feet, it's probably time to land.
Yeah, I just picked up ATIS, and it says another foot of snow before tomorrow morning. Wow.
You better get down soon, baby.
And now here's our official Airplane Geeks historian, David Vanderhoof, with his Airplane of the Week.
Plural. Airplanes of the Week.
Airplanes of the Week. What have we got this time, David?
Well, we're going to do something a little different. I'm going to focus on not one particular aircraft, but a particular mission. 55 years ago this week, on February 3rd, 1961, the U.S. Air Force Strategic Air Command began Operation Looking Glass. Looking Glass had been flown by three Boeing products, the EC-135C, the E-3B, E-6B Mercury, and the E-4B. For all those non-military AV geeks out there, that's the C-135, the original Boeing 717, the Boeing 707-320, and the Boeing 747-200. So what's Looking Glass? No, it's not the one hit wonder group that sang Brandy, nor is it Alice's Transport. Looking Glass is the National Airborne Command Post. On February 3rd, 1961, EC-135Cs began 24-hour airborne alert. The logic being, you can't first strike something that is moving. Why is it Looking Glass? Simple. It mirrored SAC's command and control on the ground. Should a first strike occur and the loss of command and control occurred, the EC-135 could launch a retaliatory nuclear strike. It also became known as the Doomsday Plane. The EC-135C looks like a KC-135, and they are capable of air-to-air refueling as well as receiving air-to-air refueling. They do have a large SATCOM antenna on top of the fuselage. Originally, Looking Glass was converted KC-135As, but they were eventually new-build EC-135Cs. The EC-135Cs had a minimum crew of 15. With at least one member of the crew being a general officer, a rank of general or higher. The EC-135C was hardened against electromagnetic pulses, or EMP. The EC-135Cs also had the TF-33 engines to provide better performance than the original J-57s. Both engines were built by the boss's engine company of choice, Pratt & Whitney. You ever see Dr. Strangelove and you haven't, and if you haven't, stop the podcast now and go watch it. We'll wait. The crew in Dr. Strangelove pulls out the EWO, or the Emergency War Order. Inside are the codes needed to determine if it's war or drill. Well, if you were flying a looking glass aircraft, inside that box would be two eye patches, one each for the pilot and the co-pilot. This was to protect one eye in case of a nuclear flash. Eventually, the patches were replaced with goggles that were turned opaque when exposed to nuclear flash. These are similar to the Dujanta 200 superchromatic peril-sensitive sunglasses of Afsad Beeblebrox. Now, if you haven't read The Restaurant End of the Universe, stop the podcast. We'll wait. So after 29 years of having at least one aircraft airborne at all times, 24/7, 365, on July 24th, 1990, the fleet changed to 24-hour ground alert, which meant the aircraft were ready to take off within 15 minutes of notification, fully crewed on the ground in case of an event. 281,000 hours of accident flying was done over 29 years. There were 11 EC-135Cs built, and they were started to be delivered to Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. Of that 11 aircraft and the EC-135As, which there were three, they were delivered. One was delivered to each numbered Air Force headquarters, the second at Barksdale, the eighth at Westover, and the 15th at March. Ah, the good old days when our Air Force was big enough to have numbered Air Forces. The EC-135 flew all the missions with the exception of one, March 4, 1980. The first NECAP E-4 was going to fly an eight-hour combined night watch and looking glass mission. It ended up being 16 hours because the EC-135, due to replace it, couldn't get airborne due to a blizzard. Looking glass was the hub of an airborne network for co-op, or continuity of operations. In the case of a nuclear war, besides being able to activate the ICBM arsenal of the United States, Looking Glass would be a headquarters for a fleet of EC-135s across the world. They would be commanding Silk Purse, an EC-135H for the Commander-in-Chief of the European Command, Scope Light, a EC-135J for the Commander-in-Chief of the Atlantic Forces, and Blue Eagle, the EC-135J for the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Forces. And last but not least, they would be supplementing Night Watch, which is the command and control aircraft for the President of the United States. Because the aircraft were heavily used and they got old, the Air Force retired the EC-135s from use and moved the Looking Glass mission to the Navy and their new fleet of E-6B Mercuries. After 37 years of flying the mission, the EC-135s were retired on October 1, 1998. The E-6A was not based on the KC-135, but based on the 707. The 707, we all know, has a wider fuselage. The E-6 was designed as a replacement for the EC-130Q, the TACAMO. TACAMO stands for Take Charge and Move Out. The EC-130Q was designed to communicate with fleet ballistic submarines. It did this by sending out a VLF, or a very low-frequency trailing radio antenna. The trailing radio antenna behind the aircraft so they could talk to the fleet of subs and, if necessary, give them the command to launch their ballistic missiles. The length of the wire was classified because if you knew the length, you knew the frequency that it was being talked on. The E-6 took over the mission because the 130s were getting old. The E-6 was the final produced 707s, and they ended in 1991. The U.S. Strategic Command, the replacement of SAC, decided it was good to consolidate the mission, making one aircraft a multitasker, combined both ICBMs on land and missiles based on submarines. The E-6 ABNCP, or Airborne National Command Post, carries a crew of 22. The current crews are made up of air crews and specialists. The information systems officer, who acts as a nexus between the air crew and the airborne battle operations team. Heading the whole mission is the airborne emergency action officer, who must be of a staff rank, either general or admiral. The E-6B uses satellite communications as well as TWA, or trailing wire antenna. This should make the airline geeks happy. because I got Ku-band antennas, 707s, and TWA into this military history story. One of the most interesting facts about Looking Glass mission is neither the president nor vice president have ever been aboard or given a tour. The reason being that should they be spotted, it might be perceived as the first steps to a nuclear first strike by the United States of America. So next week, I think we're going to go a little lower and we're going to talk about kneecaps and night watch. So this is your David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Wow. Fascinating. I mean, I guess I knew little tiny bits and pieces of that, but not as a whole like that. Very interesting, David. Thank you.
I was always amazed when I was in the Air Force at the names that they came up with.
Yes.
For certain kinds of – David, what did they call the SR-71s when – oh, they were – no, did they call them Blackbird something? No, they called them something else on the radio, didn't they?
I don't know what their call sign was in Europe, but in the Pacific it was Habu, which is Black Snake.
Hmm.
It's interesting that they don't always correspond – do they, to the manufacturer's name may be different than yes. what the flight crews call it. And then there's the fact that they have the different mission identifiers that can be really wacky names that have nothing to do with the aircraft. And speaking of the Blackbird, I've got a buddy, he's one of my mechanics who works on our airplane. He's at Arizona Air Craftsman in Prescott. He was a crew chief on the SR-71 and wrote part of the manual. He might actually be a neat guest for the show sometime. Quite a fascinating guy telling me about the systems on the SR-71.
Oh, yes, that could be very interesting.
Is he really shy?
No,
he's shy.
He acts like he's shy till he starts talking. He's a cool guy. He's very interesting.
All right.
Yeah, I like that idea.
Yeah, for sure. All right, we have a few shout-outs we wanted to make. Who's got the first one?
Max here. And I figured this might be somebody that several folks here actually know. Big shout out to Jason Blair, our flight instructor friend up in Michigan. He was just named this week, according to a Facebook post that I saw, the Michigan Flight Instructor of the Year. So congratulations, Jason. Hey. He's also formerly the executive director of NAFI, National Association of Flight Instructors.
Very good.
Hey, congratulations to Jason. And you all might appreciate knowing that Jason contributed a chapter and some of his DPE expertise to the new Savvy Flight Instructor.
Wow. See, it's a small world, you know. It's a small community when you really get down to it.
And Rob, do you know Jason?
Yes, I do, actually. I know him from NAFI, and we've met a number of times up at Air Wrencher. And I'm really glad. I'll have to shoot him an email. I didn't even hear about that.
Yeah, I was guessing both of you guys knew.
And then, Max T, you also received an email from someone?
Oh, it just came through today. John Crawford up in Vancouver, British Columbia, just wanted to say hi. He said, I'm a fan of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I'm a pilot and ops manager for a small float plane operation in the Vancouver area. I'll be in the Bay Area in a couple of weeks. I wanted to stop by and say hi. So we'll say hi to him right now.
Oh, great. And I think it was earlier in the show, I think it was, Brian, was it you that mentioned Don Sebastian?
Yep, that was me.
Well, I was listening to the Logbook podcast. That's, of course, Lucas Weekly's podcast. We've had Lucas on the show before. And in his most recent episode, I think, guess whose voice I heard? I heard the first few words and I said, that's Don, the pre-buy guy, Sebastian. So he was the storyteller in episode 26 of the Logbook podcast. We'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, definitely two distinctive voices.
Yes.
Don has his, and Lucas, gosh, for being such a young man, he is a very statesly type voice.
Yes, he does. And, you know, I really get the impression that Lucas probably recorded a lot more content than made it into the episode, but he's packaged it up really, really nicely, and it's a great listen. I mean, as the Logbook is always. And this comes from Jet City Star in the listener team. He mentioned that there's a 5-part series sponsored by Boeing. It's called The Age of Aerospace, and it's on the Science Channel. And actually, it's, as you're listening to this, the first episode is over because it was tonight that the first installment of this 5-part series. So maybe you can catch that on demand or some other means, but that's on the Science Channel. We'll put a link in the show notes to that. Sounds like it's a really interesting program worth checking out. Moving on to some listener mail. We're in trouble with listener Stuart. He's mad at us. This is concerning the topic of shining lasers at airplanes. And we had reported on a study, as I recall, this came out of Canada, I think, was it University of Calgary, that said that shining lasers into pilots' eyes doesn't cause permanent damage. And, of course, we said at the time that that doesn't mean that it doesn't cause temporary damage and, of course, is very dangerous. But Stuart didn't – I guess he didn't like the way we approached it. He thought that we were making light of the laser problem and misrepresenting or misreporting, rather, the truth, he said, saying that pilots have not suffered permanent damage. And he sends us a lot of links from the U.K., some videos that are very interesting, which show kind of a different viewpoint that, that there is damage and so forth. So I think that, you know, we were not trying to say that there was not damage because we're not qualified to, you know, to evaluate that. But I think we were just reporting on this study that had made these determinations. But really appreciate Stuart kind of pointing that out. And we'll put the links that he sent to us in the show notes so you can take a look at this. There's some interesting laser videos that kind of illustrate what this can involve.
And Max, I think one of the great things is just how vocal our listeners can be and how great it is that they write in, even when they don't agree with what we might have said or how we portray a particular story. So I think that it's just great that he wrote in with such passion to let us know what he was thinking.
Yes. Well, oddly, I think we do agree. You know, my recollection is that we did say that, shining lasers at aircraft is a really, really bad thing to do, and that we were kind of gratified to hear that this particular study said that at least when it does happen, the pilots they have tested hadn't had permanent damage, and we were happy about that as well. So I think we're all on the same side of this. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, I remember mentioning a case in California where somebody got 5 years in prison for shining lights at an airplane and said that I thought that was totally appropriate.
Yes.
So just wanted to say, Stuart, I think we've been pretty clear on the record. We really don't like people shining lasers at airplanes.
No, it's a difficult problem. And, you know, some of it's awareness, I guess. Maybe some of it is, you know, catching a few of these people and really making examples of them. I don't know. It's one of those kinds of problems, like flying drones too close to airplanes, that, you know, it happens. I think because people just aren't aware of the dangers that they're, that they're causing here. But getting that word out to everybody who might, you know, fly their quadcopter up into the sky or might shine their laser at an airplane, that's a hard thing to do.
Well, yeah, these are not the brightest bulbs on the block anyway that are trying to do this sort of thing. And so, you know, punishing them, it's a good thing, but the other folks that may be headed down the same road may not even read the newspapers or watch the news on TV and just won't even get it.
It's hard. We heard from Mark Newton. He sent an article from the Daily Beast titled "World's Most Expensive Jet Somehow Gets Worse." And this is about the F-35 and about the software. And it talks about the different versions of the software and, you know, the progression of versions that lead to increased capabilities of the airplane. And so we'll put a link in the show notes to this article. It's kind of interesting. It really points out that, you know, you might call it an airplane, but it's a computer. It's a computer.
Someone I'm close to who is familiar with this, with the training aspects and so on, also shared with me that these limitations exist. And, of course, what's happening is it takes a long time to develop all of the logic that goes with this, the procedures, the logic, and so on with a new airplane. I mean, we're all used to, we know with civilian aircraft what a big project it is to completely certify them for civilian activities. Now you go on to military activities, and there's a whole lot of special missions. So apparently the logic on it, in the sense of pilot training, is that they want to get everyone proficient in the aircraft, but their ability to complete missions that are military missions, that's something that's still being developed for that aircraft. Yes. So I thought it was quite interesting. And software, in a way, is a positive thing that allows them to get people up to speed on the aircraft first, even if they haven't completed all that. Mm.
It is so enormously complicated these days. Oh, this isn't a very scientific statement, but it's almost a miracle that they, work at all, given the complexity. I don't know what you do about that. That's the way everything is these days. We design, fighter jets now, coming soon to your automobile. We heard from Patrick Wiggins. He sent in a little story here, which I think is kind of cute. He says, "Hi guys." He says, "A young lady recently asked me what the license plate on my car meant. It reads MSGTAF. I told her Master Sergeant Air Force, the rank I retired as." And Patrick says, "She asked what I did in the Air Force, and I said, I started off working on F-4s. She thought a moment and said, Corsairs? My first reaction was surprise that the kid knew what a Corsair was. But then I said, no Phantoms, and then started wondering, do I really look that old?" So I think it's a cute little story. Thanks, Patrick, for sending that in. He also says, by the way, regarding David's comment in the last show about liking airplanes with props, he says, "I agree, but add that I like them even better if the engine the prop is attached to is round. Love the sound of radials." I think I agree with that. David wrote in and said that, "I'm sitting at Qatar Airport waiting for a 4-hour delayed flight, but there is apparently no outside viewing deck, nowhere to catch some rays whilst watching the world go by. Question, how many airports still have outside viewing decks?" I think this is a big problem. And in my answer back to him, I said that, I've really regretted the loss of observation decks at airports. At least a lot of them seem to be gone. Sort of aspect of travel that I used to love so much is gone. Somebody put in the show plan an answer to the question. Who came up with this?
Yeah, that was me.
All right, tell us what you found.
Unfortunately, it's from 2013, so the information's a little bit dated, but it's a webpage that lists a whole bunch of observation decks, and one of the corrections is for my local airport at LAX. The Encounters restaurant, although it wasn't an outdoor observation deck, was certainly a great place to watch aircraft. That, unfortunately, is closed, except at the Tom Bradley International Terminal in the Star Alliance Lounge. They've opened up a new outdoor viewing deck area, and it's a really cool place to look at aircraft if you're in the international terminal.
Well, this is at George Habaka's Airfare Watchdog site. It's airport observation decks around the world, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. As Brian says, it's from 2013, so I'm sure there's some updates. So maybe if we can get everybody to take a look at that, and like Brian, if you've got some updates, send them on to George. Maybe we can bombard George with enough.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, I'm sure he'd love that. But maybe, maybe we could see a revision. Maybe we can even find somebody who's sort of passionate about this to maintain the list. That would be nice.
And after we get done with favorite airplanes, we'll have to move on to favorite observation decks.
You go. All right. One last quick email we received was from Tom. He said, "Ever want to be a helicopter pilot?" He said, "That would be a solid 10 on the pucker scale." And he's referring to a video that he sent us. It's installation of the in-city tower spire by helicopter. And, I'll just say that it's one of those videos that's worth watching. It's the erection of segments of a tower. I don't know how many stories up, but really high up.
Yeah, It was high up.
And the guys who are up there high inside, well, they're not inside the tower tube, assembling the sections that are dropped down by helicopter. It's I don't know, man. You wouldn't get me up there doing that.
That had to have been a really calm wind day. That's all I could say. Because seeing that thing,
yes,
yeah, the big tube of metal swinging into the building, that could have been such a disaster.
Oh yes. All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, our guest was Greg Brown, author, columnist for AOPA. Greg, it was a real pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it a lot, everyone.
All right. We could have gone on for hours, and maybe we'll spend some more hours on another occasion to do that. But we really appreciate it. Let's see. Let's tell everybody quickly where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we will start with you.
Well, they'll find me on Twitter at JetWine, on Facebook at JetWine, online at the website, JetWine.com, along with Scott Spangler, and who knows where else. Of course, we're doing On the Mark with AviationPros.com. You'll find me up there, and I don't know, hanging around at Palwaukee, or we call it Chicago Executive Airport these days, just north of O'Hare.
That video, by the way, that On the Mark video, Rob, was really, really nicely done. And as those of you who are listening to this know, we played the audio from that video, but we'll also put the link to the video in the show notes.
Thank you for those kind words. That was really, I appreciate
well,
that.
Well, and even if people want to watch it, not because they want to hear it again, but just to see your sparkling eyes on that video, Rob, it just...
That was the Jack Daniels. I had about two or three shots before I started because I wanted to calm down. No, I'm
well,
just
it worked.
Kidding. No, thank you very much. It was nice to hear.
And Brian Coleman, tell our listeners where they can reach you.
Well, where I want to be found is actually at the Farnborough Air Show. So anyone that wants to help me get there, they can make a donation by going to airplanegeeks.com/Farnborough2016.
Excellent.
Yeah, or they could send me an email at brian@airplanegeeks.com.
And Max Trescott, how do folks find you?
Oh, and I just want to agree with your comments about Rob's On the Mark there. I think that really is going to turn out to be the issue of the decade for general aviation. I think it'll be of that import. So, folks, if you love general aviation, you better start gearing up to write letters to Congress, because once it changes, it's not going to go back. So, yep. So you can find me at the usual places, which is hanging out at the Palo Alto Airport if you're ever in the San Francisco Bay Area and want to go fly one of our Cirruses or other fun glass cockpit aircraft. You can find me at sjflight.com, short for SanJoseFlight.com. My books are out at g1000book.com, and I'm on Twitter and Facebook as Max Trescott, 3 T's, T-R-E-S-C-O-T-T.
Okay. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
I'll be asleep. No. you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook. And remember, we do have an Airplane Geeks Facebook page, which is Facebook/Airplane Geeks. And don't forget to check us out on Twitter, though we have 40-something thousand viewers on Twitter. So with that, oh, and last but not least, I need to congratulate my co-host for the UAV Digest, who was in this month's Drone Magazine from the UK. I get to share a little ride because my smiling face is in the article also. But a really interesting article. If you get this, if you go out and buy it, Mac talks about his miracles of podcasting and a little bit and various other places you can talk about drones. But you can always find us on Friday mornings at the UAV Digest. And again, congratulations, pal, on being the cover article for Drone Magazine.
Oh, thanks, David. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. You can find me on LinkedIn, as David mentions, at the UAVDigest.com. Also at the PaxX Podcast. .com with Mary Kirby. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you go to that site, you find all the links to where you can find us on social media, the Facebook page, Twitter, all those things. So if you want to find us in social media, go to airplanegeeks.com. Look up there on the top right-hand side. You can also find contact information there. And if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's airplanegeeks.com/387.
Did you know that if you put in cool airplane guys into Google, it brings up all of our names.
Well, I'm going to have to try that just as soon as we finish this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this really happened.
Okay.
But Brian told me.
All right. And we know Brian's always got it 100% correct. So. Opening and closing music by Brother Love. I don't know why I said that. Fine.
Yeah. We think Thanks, he Max. Does, as a matter of fact.
Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Thanks for listening.
Keep the blue side up.